bar raids, street harassment, being locked up against your will in psychiatric institutions. Historically, this was your reality if you were a queer or trans person in North America. In response to this treatment, queer and trans people struggled and organized. Recent social gains and increasing acceptance means many queer and trans people, particularly those who are more privileged, no longer face the same degree of criminalization. But it has also meant that the connections between queerness, gender, and these institutions of social control are not as obvious as they once were. Sarah Lamble argues that these connections do indeed still exist. And for those of us who are involved in queer, gender, anti-violence, and prison justice work, an understanding of these connections is essential if we're to be effective in our goal for self-determination and liberation. Lamble is a gender and queer activist who's been involved in struggles around prison abolition, anti-racism, and globalization issues, both in Canada and the United Kingdom. As part of her PhD, she is working on a project called Transforming Bodies of Knowledge, Legal Institutions, Queer and Trans Activism, and Social Movement Politics in Canada. I spoke to Lamble recently on the phone from her home in England about her work and these issues. Thanks for joining us. It's great to have this opportunity to explore these issues with you.
It's great to be chatting with you today.
So can you tell us a little bit about your PhD project and research?
The project is, I'm interested in looking at how queer and trans activists are doing kind of grassroots radical activism in areas that haven't been conventionally sort of labeled as LGBT issues. So I'm looking at queer activism and trans activism around prison issues, around border and immigration issues, and around anti-capitalist globalization work. And so I'm interested in how activists are doing work that kind of creates new ways of seeing the world or being in the world and kind of creates new kinds of political possibilities.
And what kind of things are you finding out from this work?
Well, it's interesting because I think there's been a long history of queer and trans activism in all of those different areas. And I think queer and trans activists and analysis plays a really important role in how those various movements have kind of shaped their politics and engage in the kind of work that they're doing. But for some reason, in more recent years in particular, I think it's not quite as visible as it used to be. So I'm, just looking at some of the ways in which some of those links have been made. And it's pretty exciting, actually, to be able to interview activists who are doing this kind of work and learn about how what kind of the ways in which their queer and trans politics are really shaping their activism and what role that plays.
And how did you get there? How did you get interested or come to study this question?
It's an interesting question for me because I've sort of maneuvered in and out of different kind of activist scenes for a long time. But I've always done stuff around sort of gender and sexuality. And also, in the last few years, done a lot of work around prison stuff. And I guess, for me, one of the biggest challenges for doing work around prisons is trying to create a kind of possibility for people to think about a world without prisons, which means that you have to kind of think outside the box, in a way. And when I was doing a lot of that work and still doing that work, it always kind of surprised me how many queer and trans people were involved in those struggles. And so I wanted to do some work around looking at those connections and trying to make more visible the impact of a kind of queer and trans analysis on some of those political issues.
So why do you think there are so many queer and trans people involved in that kind of organizing around prison abolition and other related issues?
It's interesting because I keep asking the people that I've interviewed about this very question, and people have lots of different kinds of responses to it. And one of them is that some people think, well, it's a kind of echo of earlier generations of organizing. So as you mentioned, doing work around imprisonment was a really key focus for kind of gay liberation movements, in the 60s, 70s, and sort of in the early 80s, even around the Bath raids and stuff like that. And so I think there's a way in which that earlier activism has sort of influenced younger activism. So there's that element of it. I also think there's an element around queer and trans people having experienced some of the, you know, the oppression of being excluded or being labeled deviant or being, you know, raised in a world that's not necessarily supportive or encouraging to queer and trans people. And so there's a sense of, I think, a solidarity that can come out of that from making connections between people who are excluded because of their gender and sexuality and people who get marginalized and criminalized and sort of isolated in the prison system. So I think there's that kind of element as well. But I also think there's the fact that queer and trans people are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. They're overrepresented in prisons. Now, I always, actually, it's interesting that I'm using the language of overrepresented because I think that implies that there might be a proper representation of queer and trans people in the prison. And as an abolitionist, I don't think we should have anybody represented in the prison system. But I do think that we need to pay more attention to the ways in which queer and trans people, particularly queer and trans youth of color and queer and trans people coming from low-income communities, are targeted and criminalized by the criminal justice system and so end up getting funneled into the prison system at quite high rates.
Yeah, I mean, historically, those connections between queerness and gender nonconformity and being criminalized by the state are more obvious. People might not see those direct connections as much today. Can you tell us a little bit more about how queer and trans people are more susceptible to being criminalized and ending up being incarcerated, what that whole process involves?
Yeah, I think in some ways that there's, because a lot of the kind of laws on the books that were overtly transphobic or overtly homophobic, many of those laws have been overturned, particularly in the Canadian context. At least in terms of homophobic laws, there are very few laws on the books that would count in that way. There are still, I think there are a lot of laws that still need to be changed around trans issues in the Canadian context, but there's an assumption that if you don't have a law that explicitly criminalizes queer and trans people, then somehow it means that the law protects people equally or treats people fairly. But I think that's actually a misreading of how people get targeted by the system, right? So if people are experiencing oppression or they're feeling marginalized or they've experienced abuse, which might be related to the fact that they're gender nonconforming or they're queer, then they're more likely to get funneled into the system for social, economic, racial kind of reasons. So to give a kind of example, if you've got a young trans youth and they are really struggling because they feel like they can't express themselves and they feel like maybe their family is not accepting of their gender identity or maybe they get harassed and bullied at school and so they might drop out of school or they might get kicked out of their home. And so once they've sort of lost the, you know, educational opportunities or the home situation is not good, then they end up on the street, they can't get a job, or maybe they can't get a job because they're discriminated against because they're gender nonconforming. And so you can see how people end up being sort of homeless, unemployed, on the street, that kind of thing. And then people, when they're in that situation, they get sort of funneled into criminalized economies like sex trade or drug trade or, you know, stealing to survive. And all of those things then end up funneling you into the criminal justice system. So I think we need to look beyond laws that are explicitly homophobic and explicitly transphobic and look at the ways in which the legal system targets people that are kind of vulnerable and, you know, the ways more broadly our social system doesn't support people who are vulnerable or exposed to systemic violence or systemic abuse, and so they end up getting funneled into the criminal justice system.
And what about when queer and trans people end up in prison? How are they treated, and how does queerness and gender play out in a prison setting? What's that like?
Well, I think another thing that we need to look at, aside from the kind of whether or not there are a disproportionate number of queer and trans people in prison, is that prisons as institutions are very, they enforce the gender binary, right? And they arguably reinforce oppressive gender and sexual norms. And that's because historically the prisons were designed in such a way as to reinforce certain gender ideals and certain gender norms. So, you know, women's prisons were designed differently in some ways from men's prisons because they were designed to take so-called fallen women and make them into good mothers and good housewives and good domestic servants, right? Whereas men were sort of funneled into a different kind of system in order to make them better masculine citizens or better workers. And though that legacy of having, you know, a very gendered system of norms in the prison system is still with us today. It certainly hasn't been abandoned. The other thing is that sexual violence is used to reinforce power structures in the prison. And so it can be used by guards, it can be used by other prisoners, but using violence to punish people who've not conformed in a particular way or are not behaving as they're supposed to be according to gender sexual norms is a regular part of prison life. So that's a whole set of things that I think queer and trans people need to be challenging. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I think we should oppose the prison system. But having said that, in that context, it means that when trans and queer people end up in the prison system, they're much more vulnerable to assault and to abuse. And trans people also are, because the prison system is a gender binary system, and it's not, it in some ways doesn't know how to deal with people who don't fit neatly into the kind of gender binary. And so trans people are often held in cells with people of a different gender, and that also puts them at grave danger in lots of situations. Or people are held in segregation. And it's said that it's for their safety, but we know that even if it's, you know, for so-called protective reasons, it means when you're in segregation that you don't have access to, you know, programs like day programs or educational programs or other kinds of things. So the experience of queer and trans people in prison is pretty horrendous.
And you have working with others on this project, the Queer and Trans Prisoner Pen Pal program. Can you tell us a bit more about that program and what kind of things you're learning through the connection with queer and trans people on the inside?
The project is just a new project here in England or in Britain, and it takes inspiration from projects that have existed elsewhere. So one of the projects that we take a lot of inspiration from is the project in Montreal, the Prisoners Correspondence Project. And there's also a similar project run by the Sylvia Rivera Law Project in New York City. And these projects are also based on projects that existed many, many years ago. So like in the 60s and the 70s, in the kind of gay liberation period, queers on the outside were writing to queers on the inside in trying to enact kind of solidarity. And then a lot of those projects actually kind of died out in the 80s, I think, as there was a deliberate shift made from doing a kind of gay or queer liberation politics to one that was about kind of respectability and legal rights. And so prisoners didn't fit within that politics. And so a lot of those projects got dropped. And so this project is trying to bring that kind of solidarity across prison walls politics back into queer and trans organizing. And so we have just started. So we basically take requests from people who are in prison, who want to have a pen pal. So queer and trans people or gender nonconforming people can request to have a pen pal, and then we match them with somebody who's not in prison, who's also queer or trans or gender nonconforming, so that we can make sort of connections between those on the inside and those on the outside. And one of the other kinds of benefits of the project is it's a way of monitoring what's going on in the prisons, because most prison, you know, prisons don't keep track of how many queer and trans people they have. And, you know, even if they did, I'm sure a lot of prisoners would not feel safe disclosing their identity. It's often really dangerous for them to do that. So this is a way of sort of keeping an eye on what's going on in the prison so that prisoners can tell us what they're experiencing and how things are going, and we can try and provide more supports to keep people a bit safer when they're on the inside. So we just started the project, and I just put a notice in the prisoner newsletter that circulates in the prisons. And so that notice went in February, and we've already had 100 requests for pen pals. So, and the letters are pretty incredible, just reading how people are surviving in the prison system. And we've had some amazing letters from people who are trying to organize inside and do things for LGBT History Month and provide support to other prisoners, and it's pretty amazing.
Wow, 100 letters, that's a lot in a month.
Yeah, it's a lot of work at the moment. So, I mean, I'm sure most of your listeners will be in the Canadian context, but if there's anybody in the UK who happens to listen to this, we're desperately looking for people who are on the outside who are willing to be pen pals.
It just really shows that there is a need there for that connection.
Yeah, it's interesting because a couple prisoners who've written to us have said things like, you know, there's a gay and lesbian union or like a branch of the union for the prison guards, but there's nothing for us prisoners. And a few prisoners have also said, you know, they've written to some of the more mainstream gay and lesbian organizations in the UK and haven't got a response, right? So I think part of the need is arising from the fact that there just aren't enough supports and connections being made around queer and trans issues and prison issues. So yeah, I think the need is pretty high.
And I think, I think some of it touches upon this whole sort of shift in the queer community in North America. As the communities gain more acceptance and is less directly criminalized, the focus of queer activism has changed. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about how these changes have affected the way that queer and trans activists engage and relate to the criminal justice system.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I feel like the more kind of mainstream rights-based LGBT kind of politics, it's almost as if we have a really short memory, or I shouldn't say we, because I don't necessarily identify as part of that kind of movement, but it's like we've forgotten, or it's forgotten the way in which the state has been used historically to criminalize and punish us for not conforming to gender or sexual norms. But as soon as the state stops doing that to some of us, namely those of us who are, you know, class privileged or race privileged, it's almost as if we think, okay, well, then it's fine that the state does this to other people. And I think that's totally the wrong kind of political approach to take. And it saddens me, actually. So a really interesting example to think about in the UK is there was a group that was founded, it was originally called Gallup. I guess it still has that name, but it was something like the gay, it was like for monitoring police brutality, basically. I think it was like Police Monitoring Association or something. And they, their goal was to basically monitor the police for harassing gay men, gay and lesbian men, or gay and lesbian women, around, you know, when people were getting targeted for having sex in, you know, toilets or in public parks or whatever, and also challenging the way in which police were physically harassing and assaulting queers. And so that was what their mandate was in the kind of 80s. And then they shifted, and now their main mandate is to combat transphobic and homophobic hate crime. And so, but what they do in order to target hate crime is they work with the police. So a group that used to challenge the police and the police's use of brutality against, you know, marginalized people has now shifted. So the state is no longer the perpetrator of violence. The state is the protector against violence. And I mean, I think we need to be doing a lot of work around hate crimes, and we need to take those issues quite seriously. But I think we're mistaken if we think that the police and the state is going to be able to protect us from that violence, when it wasn't very long ago that they were officially using violence against us in those ways. And they still do. I mean, they still target queer and trans youth that are on the street. They target, you know, trans women that are on the street, are just, you know, walking down the street or trying to use the toilet or whatever it is. There's still a lot of harassment and targeting of particular groups of people, particularly queer and trans youth of color. So that, I think the part of the problem is that the more mainstream gay and lesbian rights movement has sort of forgotten or neglected the priorities of a huge segment of the kind of queer and trans community.
I guess I'm wondering the way that some people in the queer community respond to queer bashings is to call for justice within that framework of harsher action by the criminal justice system. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a bit about
what you think we should be doing instead, or how we need to be sort of reframing some of those incidences where we do go and look to the state or the police or the criminal justice system to intervene, to engage, to respond to that kind of level of violence?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing that I would want to say is I understand to some level why people, you know, when a hate crime occurs or, you know, a transphobic or homophobic murder occurs, I can see why people, the kind of response that they have is to call for justice in the way of, like, let's lock those people up and, you know, they deserve punishment in this kind of conventional justice kind of way. I know why people have those kind of sentiments, and it's because we've come to believe that justice is about punishment. And unfortunately, I think that that's not, I mean, where people are coming from is actually they need healing and they need, you know, they want to feel like people are taking this violence seriously and are going to do something about it. But unfortunately, I don't think that any of those sort of harsher criminal justice measures have actually worked for us. Like, bringing in hate crime legislation hasn't, it doesn't seem to me anyway, and it doesn't seem to be that there's a lot of evidence to show that those harsher penalties or the introduction of, you know, crimes or sort of laws against homophobic or transphobic hate crimes, that they have done anything to actually protect our communities from violence. And so I think what we need to be doing is moving away from those approaches that are really backward-looking and saying, you know, who did it and how do we punish them? And we need to be focusing much more on prevention. What is it that we need to do to stop these things from happening in the first place? We also need to be looking at other models of intervention, because when we look at a lot of, like, homophobic or transphobic sort of crimes that happen on the street, often there are witnesses. Often there are people around. Often these things happen, like, at parties or in, you know, at school or other kinds of places, and people don't intervene. They don't actually, you know, stop these things while they're happening. And I think we need to develop kind of skills around that. Like, how do we spot these things before they get, you know, out of hand, and how do we intervene early? So that's another kind of set of skills that I think we need to develop. And I think there are a lot of groups that are trying to do that work. So there's a group, the SOS Project, which is Safe Outside the System Project of the Audre Lorde Project, in New York City, and they are doing some amazing work around this, where they're, and it's primarily young queers of color who don't feel safe going to the sort of criminal justice system to deal with violence that they experience because they're queer or trans. And so they're like, we need to develop our own kind of community protocols around this, because, you know, for lots of people, they don't have the option of going to the police, even if the police system was useful or it worked. You know, immigrants or people who are undocumented, people who've experienced police brutality in the past, those folks aren't going to be able to go to the, you know, police for help. Or, you know, there are too many examples as well when people have gone to the police for help and the police assume that they were the perpetrator and they've experienced violence at the hands of the police when they were seeking help. So, and that's particularly true around people who have mental health issues that they're dealing with. So I guess the first thing is that system's not actually working for us. So I think it's a mistake to try and improve the system or invest more resources into that system. We need to be looking outside that system and coming up with more community-based approaches. And so I think, again, the focus should be on prevention, the focus should be on intervention, and then when these things do happen, when incidents of violence happen in our communities, we need to find better ways of calling people to real accountability, because putting people in jail is also not making them accountable. They might be, I mean, that in some ways could be seen as accountability to the state, but I don't even think that's the case. Putting someone in jail is not. They don't have to come to terms in any way with what they've done, and they don't have to face the community who they've harmed, right? So I think we need to come up with other kinds of community accountability models, and also we need to come up with better systems for healing, because a lot of people who experience violence or are left behind, you know, if in terrible cases where people are killed, you know, the family members and the friends and the community that's left behind, the criminal justice system does very little for them in terms of helping them to process and deal with that, you know, tremendous loss. And so I think we need to be doing much better work and much more sort of grassroots community-based work around prevention, intervention, and kind of healing and response.
And you're working with CORE, which is an organization working to stop the expansion of prisons in England. How do you see the expanding prison system and sort of the whole global picture connecting to queerness and some of the issues you were mentioning?
Well, I think the first thing is that the kind of crisis around imprisonment is, you know, is reaching just outrageous proportions. And so we can look at places like the U.S. and see 1 in 100 American adults are behind bars. And those patterns of expansion are happening elsewhere, right? So England right now, England and Wales are about to embark on a £2.3 billion prison building spree, and they want to build 3 U.S. style, what they're calling Titan prisons, which are these kind of massive warehouse style prisons, and they will be private prisons. And I think, you know, when we see these trends happening elsewhere, I know that there are, you know, discussions happening with the Harper government around building new federal prisons in Canada. You know, elsewhere there's prison expansion happening. And so these are all, I think, connected to changes in the global economy as well. So you've got a defunding of, you know, welfare, education, health, you know, all that kind of stuff. Those budgets are being decreased while prisons and policing budgets are being increased. And so where the connection is around queer and trans stuff is that we're getting, as the prison population expands, we're getting a clearer line between those who are likely to get funneled into the system and those who won't get into the system, those who are kind of protected from getting into that system. And so I find increasingly there are queers that are taking a kind of pro-criminalization stance or a pro, you know, prison expansion stance, or, and that's also connected to kind of pro-military stances as well. And so I think, you know, these things are related to the kind of experiences that queer folks are having when the programs that they need are being defunded. So, you know, it might be health programs around HIV and AIDS. It might be queer education programs that are focused on helping queers stay in school and not drop out. It might be programs around dealing with sexual assault and abuse. Those kinds of programs, when we take away those programs, it makes it harder for queer and trans people to survive, right? And so then they get funneled into the system. And so, you know, as the prison population is expanding dramatically and in a kind of global way, I think it's more important than ever that we fight that system and we fight to have resources taken out of the prison system and put back into the kinds of programs that are actually going to benefit our communities and are actually going to work to keep us safer from violence, from harm, from discrimination, from abuse, from systemic racism, those kind of things.
So you're working on more of the project and research and getting into these issues, and there's a lot there. What kind of things give you hope, or where are you hoping to head, and what types of things you're hoping to learn from all this exploration and all this work that you're doing?
Well, the first thing is, on the one hand, I feel like the situation can feel really bleak in the sense of just the rate of prison expansion that's happening, the kind of, you know, we can also feel really bleak about the prevalence of things like violence on the street or violence in our homes, those kinds of things. But at the same time, I also feel so much hope and so much inspiration from the kind of grassroots work that's being done on the ground to build alternatives and to say we don't have to live in a world that is like this, and we can, and we also don't have to wait for somebody else to do something. We can start right now in our communities building these alternative ways or alternative responses that focus on preventing, intervening, and responding to violence or harm that happens in our communities. And one of the things that I find most inspiring is the work that's done by groups like Critical Resistance in the U.S., groups like the Sylvia Rivera Law Project in New York, groups like Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, you know, the project, the Prisoner Correspondence Project in Montreal. Like, there are lots of exciting work that people are doing, and it's, you know, there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of young people involved, and there's really good results that people are getting from this work. So I guess if it's one thing to leave people with, it's, you know, find out there's probably stuff going on in your community that connects to these issues in ways that you can get involved. And I guess the other thing is that, I mean, if prison abolition work is about building alternatives, it's not just necessarily fighting the prison system, right? It's trying to create these other alternatives in our community. So the importance is to bring a kind of prison abolition analysis to the work that we do. So maybe you do work on housing and you're a housing activist, or maybe you do anti-violence work, or maybe you do stuff on, you know, healthcare trends, access to healthcare. So I think it's important to continue doing that work, but to do that work bringing a kind of queer and trans prison abolition analysis to it, so that in the process of doing whatever work that you're doing, you're not inadvertently feeding the criminal justice system or inadvertently contributing to the ways in which some queer and trans people get excluded from our communities and other people get included in the communities. So I think there's a lot of really great resources out there, and there's a lot of really great work that's being done out there, and we just need to make those connections stronger.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and helping us explore some of these issues that I don't think get talked about too often.
It's been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Lamble. She's a gender and queer activist who's been involved in struggles around prison abolition, anti-poverty, anti-racism, and globalization issues. And she's currently working on a project, a part of her PhD research. It's called Transforming Bodies of Knowledge, Legal Institutions, Queer and Trans Activism, and Social Movement Politics in Canada. She is also a contributor to the upcoming book called Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment and the Prison Industrial Complex. If you want to find more information about the Queer and Trans Prisoner Pen Pal project that she mentioned, it's called Bent Bars, and you can email them at bent.bars.project@gmail.com.